someone who's strong can maybe help me carry Susanna.
Oh, yeah.
Huh?
She just hurt her leg.
What?
Oh, really?
And the nurse comes too.
Why not?
Good. Why not? Yeah.
Perfect.
Yikes.
I wonder what's happened.
The steps about coming down from the kitchen, it's quite dark. And
there is a light there, but it's hard to find the light switch. But there is, I think there is one. I remember.
Yeah, we can find it and leave it on.
Yeah.
After dinner.
Yeah.
That's it.
There's some switch there inside the kitchen.
Uh-huh.
I think this one is on the pole to the left.
Uh-huh.
Let's look. Too bad.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama,
Rama Rama,
Hare Hare,
Hare Hare. Krishna, Krishna,
Hare Hare,
Hare Hare,
Hare Rama,
Hare Rama,
Hare Rama,
Hare Rama,
Rama Rama,
Rama Rama,
Hare Hare,
Hare Hare. Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna,
Krishna Krishna,
Krishna Krishna,
Hare Hare,
Hare Hare,
Hare Rama,
Hare Rama,
Hare Rama,
Hare Rama. Krishna,
Hare Hare,
Hare Hare,
Hare Rama,
Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, 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 Hare, Hare.
Something is approaching.
Yes.
It's a hard one.
If I was alone in the tent, I'd be quite scared of it.
Yes, that's it.
Like a werewolf.
Yesterday you said that it can be hard to meditate after pranayama, but in the end, am I not supposed to be able to differentiate myself from prana as well? I would think so. But it's such a strong force field. It's so, there's an absorption into the prana itself. So it's just, I don't know quite how to talk about that, but I find for myself it's nice to let it settle down before I try to really do nididhyasana. Or if I'm just sometimes at Mangalam when we've done it, say if I want to do inner child work or something like that, the mind's not really available for that. But if I let it all settle for some time, sometimes as much as a half an hour, then my mind is available for some of these other things. So that's just my experience, you know. So I end up absorbing into the prana. It's not bad. I mean, it's just, it's what it is for me. In daily life, when small reactions occur, i.e. irritation, am I supposed to speak to my inner children then? Or is inner child conversation only necessary when it becomes overwhelming, i.e. if I see a negative thought pattern arise but I can easily let it go, then I don't need to make it bigger than it is, like comforting the child. I find that that's true. It's like all kinds of things can pass through the mind, and some can be an irritation or something, but it's not a big deal. And it's very easy to just let it keep going. Then there's really, no unconscious pattern that's really hanging on to that. But say if you are doing inner child work on a regular basis and those little ones are inside, you can feel them inside. You can feel that presence. And so there's nothing wrong with acknowledging them when you're feeling their presence. Or just telling them I'm here, or letting them know, letting that part of your unconscious know that you're present to all of that. That's very comforting to the unconscious, especially when there's a lot of energy that's being held inside, you know, which is basically the energy that was the trauma in the first place. And so when that's inside, you can feel that it's kind of like a vortex. It's pulling your attention to it. And so when that's the case, remember, I would sometimes, the little one that I had, my little girls, my little self, she was always with me. I could always feel her, and so I would carry her around with me. You know, I didn't have to be talking to her, she was just always with me until that, all of that kind of dissipated into my conscious mind. And then she was just part of me as the conscious mind, and you couldn't make the differentiation anymore. So that was... Also, being able to see that thoughts or irritations or whatever can come up in the mind, and it's perfectly all right just to let that keep going, you know? Because you don't want to... Why get involved in that? It's so not worth it. And unless it's gripping something, you know, some complex inside or some trauma inside, there is... Then we need to say what's really going on there, and let that little girl or let that part of you really talk to you and tell you what's really upsetting you. Right? But if it doesn't have that strength, these things, these unkindnesses, these irritations, it's all of this, it's, or jealousies or whatever it happens to be, it's not worth it to go there. It's just suffering and sorrow, and there's no need to do it. So if you have you have the option to be able to let it go. If that option is there, then we let it go. Yeah. And if we're going to work something out with somebody, you don't want to try to work it out when you're irritated or angry. You know, that doesn't really work. Usually that's just an escalation because you're not in your right mind. when you're upset and angry and all of this, or you're not in your right mind, in the sense that your mind is not coming from your own being, it's overwhelmed by that emotion. And so it's not you talking, it's the emotion talking, it's the anger talking. And instead of letting the anger talk, you should be being with the anger, you know, to find out what that's about and to reframe it and take care of that yourself before exposing others to it. Nobody wants to have to deal with somebody's anger. It's hurtful. Does Bhagavan have a big plan for human beings? Does it want us to have more people to share the truth in terms of social media? Does Bhagavan have a big plan for human beings? Does he want us to have more people to share the truth in parents in terms of social media? I don't know that it's like that or not, you know. In terms of a big plan, that it does really seem like when we talk about prarabdha karma, and we talk also about the collective karma that we all find ourselves in, that there is the unfoldment of karma and there is the unfoldment of your life, so there is an order. But I don't think Bhagavan's making a plan. It's just that Bhagavan's expression is the plan. And the expression of the creation, which includes you, has an order, is orderly. And there is a natural expression of Ishwara that you are part of. And so whatever that expression is, it includes you. And so to be sensitive to that expression. It's good. So now, say you're thinking about, does Bhagavan want a lot of mumukshus? I don't know how to say something like that, but I would say that whenever there is a mumukshu, that they will have their teacher, you know. And if in kind of the waves of the way the creation goes, sometimes there's more mumukshus than others. Sometimes there's more interest. You know, like 20 years ago or something, when I first started teaching at CIS, the name of that school is California Institute of Integral Studies, and it was founded by an Indian couple who really wanted to bring the Eastern traditions to the West. And because the West was quite advanced in terms of psychology, but the Eastern traditions incorporate psychology, and there's kind of because there's the moksha in all of the different Eastern traditions, because that moksha is there, liberation is there as part of the pinnacle of the main part of why that's the main goal of the tradition, whether it be Buddhism or Sankhya Yoga or Vedanta or anything, this moksha, liberation. So he wanted to bring that to the West and let students know about it and be able to study it and understand. And so I know that, so I got there in 1996, and there was a tremendous amount of interest among the student body, and it probably had been so for the last 10 years or so, even or more before I came. A lot of interest. Students were coming to that school really for the East. And I was actually hired there because of my teaching. And I had a PhD. So that's kind of an unusual combination to be, you know, somebody who's teaching Vedanta and they also have a PhD. That's not very normal. So they were happy to, you need a PhD to teach in the States, you need a PhD to teach in the university. So they hired me, but there was certainly no shortage of students or no shortage of interest. It was very live. And now, for the last, maybe the last 5 or 6 years, there's some little bit of interest, but not that much. It's more shamanism, entheogens, holistic sexuality, kind of immediate gratification type of courses. And now, just now, in this last couple of semesters, there seems to be more students coming again who are interested in Vedanta or interested in yoga, you know. So it's just funny that it goes like in waves. But I think there's just certain laws in the creation. I don't know how to explain that, but we experience it. And to know what Bhagavan's plan is to be present to it.
Yeah. What's the second you said? Shamanism and then you said the second. That people are interested now?
Yeah. In Vedanta,
entheogens,
entheogens. Entheogens. We call them entheogens. What do you call them? Entheogens are just they call them medicine. Entheogens, medicine, but they're really like psilocybin and PFT and ayahuasca and all these type of mind-altering drug experiences that are dealt with and handled a little differently than they used to be in the 60s. Still the same drugs. No, they're not. Actually, a lot of them are from Peru and are shamanic. Some of the shamanic, they call them plant medicines, but they are entheogens, means they give you a psychedelic experience, or whatever the word for that is now. But they're also viewed as a medicine, they're viewed as a spiritual. They're not just taken to have fun or something like that. They're taken for a spiritual understanding, the spiritual experience. So that's very, very popular in the West now. I don't know if it is. Is it also popular in like Sweden and
here? Yeah.
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 Okay, so it's just the Western. Western. So. But now, so that's been the case for quite a few years, and now, for some reason, the Eastern traditions are making a little comeback.
Mm-hmm.
So. Mm. Who knows? We don't know what Bhagavan's long-term plan is. We know about the four yugas. I always kind of been watching his plan unfold. You know, when you watch these movements, these big movements that take place in the creation, it's just a huge, you know, like there's this huge rise of authoritarianism. But it's not, it's really, I don't even know what to say about what's happening in the States, but the States is not the only place that this is happening. There's other places in the world that there's a big rise in this movement, and the alt-right is rising up all over the world. And I don't know. There's a lot of change going on. All the migrations are happening, which are throwing things out of balance in the global warming. We're in quite a time. It's quite a time to be living. It said in the Tattva Bodha today that the Stula Sharirum is the ayatanam for Sukha, Dukkha, etc. But it seems to me that Sukha, Dukkha are more experienced in the mind, or at least in the mind also. Please clarify. Yeah, now, there's a difference when they're talking about the Sukshma Sharira and the Stula Sharira, the physical body and the subtle body. The physical body is said the ayatanam. That's the counter of experience, like the physical body is the place where the subtle body is abiding. The subtle body fills this physical body, and the physical body is made of the same material, food basically, made of the same materials as this physical loka. Like say, just to think that, say in your dream, the body that you take in the dream will be of the same material as the dream material. If you take a body in another loka that is more subtle, for instance, your body will be made of the same material as that loka, so that it matches. So that physical body becomes the counter through which the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, is able to experience this physical world, right? So the subtle body takes on this physical body, or pervades this physical body, which then gives this counter, is becomes a counter of experience for the sukshma sharira to exhaust its raga dveshas and to be the means for the sadhana, right? The sadhana for experiencing pleasure and pain. So the subtle body it's through the subtle sense organs, using these physical sense organs, and it's the subtle mind, right, which the sense organs give this data to. The subtle mind's counterpart would be the brain. And so these subtle sense organs use these physical sense organs to experience the world and give it a vritti, which is subtle, and its counterpart would be the physical brain, to give me the experiences that I react to positively, or I react to negatively, or I react to indifferently. All of that is the subtle body, the sukshma sharira, because the mind, the mind and the sense organs belong to the sukshma sharira. These physical organs are just counters that the sukshma sharira is using in order to experience this world. So that's the subtle difference. Like if you look at the two, the little paragraph on the stula sharira, the physical body, and then the paragraph on the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, you'll see that they use the different terms, exactly the same statement, except for the physical body they use ayatanam, the subtle body they use sadhana. So the ayatana is the counter through which the means for the experience of these sukha dukkha adi. you know, take place. So you're right about the mind. It's just that the mind is located in this physical body. As long as this physical body is alive, as long as you have the prarabdha karma. Once your prarabdha karma exhausts, then this body is left behind and it just goes back into its elements. It decomposes because it's dead. It's been left behind. Is it? Is there any part of the personality that can travel to next lives, or are we completely new in our personality every time? Oh, Shiva. Okay, I can't read without this. If I took Shiva back to the farm, my neighbor would be over with his guns. To be hiding out in the house. Is there any part of the personality that can travel to next lives? In a way, you have a fresh start, in the sense that you have a fresh brain that has no imprints, really. But the sukshma sharira does have imprints. It does bring things, it's called samskaras. It does bring things, capacities with it. And so those samskaras can express themselves, you know. Also, we found that, of course, this is all anecdotal, so it hasn't been proven, but there's many instances of past life memories, especially for young children coming in, taking this birth. They're coming into a fresh body, a fresh brain, but they're bringing strong samskaras and strong memories that may last for some period of time, or your body may, they may be able to carry those memories for some time. So yes, it's a fresh start, and yes, you have some scars. You have tendencies. And also, like say, if in your last life you're a great tennis player or pianist or something, or a mathematician, you could be a prodigy. Because you're bringing that extraordinary mastery with you as a samskara. And then you find, we've seen this with a little child playing amazing pieces of music, impossible, little three-year-old playing. You can see it on YouTube, it's unbelievable, you know. Or children who have this tremendous capacity for math or for language, say they're bringing something with them, you know. So it's not exactly that you bring your personality with you, but you bring certain samskaras, certain tendencies with you. And another interesting thing is, say you were a beautiful, wonderful pianist. You spent your life you're doing in orchestra and all of this, and you know, performances, and so you bring those samskaras with you, but you're also burnt out. You have no interest at all in doing that. That's, we see that also, because you have tremendous capacity, but that's not what you're meant to do in this lifetime, even though it's kind of unusual, but we see that. Even though you have this incredible capacity, you have no interest in going in that direction. It's kind of like, been there, done that, I don't want to do it anymore. So those are what we call samskaras. It's a little different than personality. Yeah. On the other hand, then you, the personality that you end up having is also kind of natural to the upadhi and the parents and where exactly where you were born and your parents and your family. They're also instrumental to who you are, really, in terms of a jiva, your personality and all of that. And you were attracted to this familial situation. So your parents are not away or separate from your karma. You know, and so even though, say, your parents have their own problems, their own hurts, their own upbringing that has stifled them or hurt them in different ways, and that's passed on to the child. You know, that whole thing is part of your karma. You're not separate from it. You fit into that situation. And so you're also exhausting your own karma, finding yourself in that situation, which is kind of interesting, you know, to think of it that way, where you have to kind of, instead of just thinking that maybe you got a really bad deal here, is if you think about it in terms of prarabdha karma, you got exactly what you deserve, as Swamiji would say. When we say that, it sounds very negative. When he says it, he doesn't mean it that way. This is where you fit in. This is who you are as a jiva. This is your circumstance. This is your karma. You know, and so your task is to be present to your life, receive your life as the prasad, you know, and also respond to your life as Ishwar, as it is Ishwar. So that's the whole karma yoga buddhi for gaining the antakarna shuddhi that helps you to really be receptive to this knowledge. Because if your mind is so extrovert, you know, I want this and I want that, and this person's acting like this and this person's acting like that, it's just so, your mind is so complicated and so hung up in all of these emotional angst, you know, and the pressure of trying to arrange things so you can be happy, that it doesn't have room or availability to, or even desire to gain this knowledge. The very fact that you're here means that you do have that availability. So, yeah. Or you wouldn't be here. There's no way you sit for all these classes and everything. How would you do it? You have no interest whatsoever. You're sitting for an hour three or four times a day. Will not happen. Be quiet. I have strong dreams almost every night. I dream long stories with a lot of emotions. I make new friends, get married, get pregnant, have sex, etc. I love dreaming. Yeah. Nice. But it's not unusual that I make that I wake up exhausted, since I've been having so since I've been having so many things going on the whole night. It feels like I've been awakened, that all these things happen to for real. Sometimes it takes half a day to get the night out of my system. Sometimes more, I feel a bit crazy sometimes, but living in my dreams, what do I do? That situation is pretty, I've heard of this, people have this situation. I've heard of it before. It's not the normal situation. I mean, most people don't have such real dreams that last, that are so detailed, that will like take you through the whole evening, you know, the whole time that you're asleep. You're not really sleeping, you're dreaming. You know, so that, in fact, would be, I think it would be pretty tiring, and I don't really know what to do about that, because I don't really know what the cause for that is, for the mind being so active in that way. Why is it active like that? You know, because there are the dream-wake cycles that are where the person is not normally dreaming all the time. There are cycles where you should be actually in very deep sleep, and then cycles where you'd be dreaming. There have been a lot of studies on this to see the sleep, you know, the wake-dream deep-sleep cycles. And so to have that much, that vivid of dreaming the whole, basically the whole night long, that there might be interludes that you're not aware of, but you know, I think that would be very exhausting actually, and I would probably look too into it medically, even though I would also, I mean, I enjoy my dreams. When I have dreams, I don't dream that much actually. Or I don't remember. If I do dream a lot, I don't remember them. But I enjoy the dreams as long as they're not scary ones. If the dreams are like interesting stories, interesting situations that aren't scary, that would be kind of fun and maybe kind of addictive in a way, you know? But if they turn dark or scary, that is not fun. I know people who have what's called night terrors, and when they go to sleep, they will have dreams that are absolutely terrifying and wake them up. They'll end up sitting up, you know. And so those are very, very vivid dreams, hard to separate them from reality. They're so vivid. They're so scary, you know. And so I wouldn't want those kind of dreams. So, and I think that both kind of dreams can be there. I don't think there's just one kind of dream. I think that, because there's not just one type of content of the psyche. The psyche actually has a lot of darkness in it. The shadow has a lot of darkness in it, because those are things that are repressed. So dreams often have a dark side also, you know, a scary side. So if you have a lot of anxiety, you'll have anxious dreams. Or a lot of guilt, you'll have very guilty dreams or scary dreams. So that seems like an overwhelming fun, both fun and overwhelming. And I don't know how to tell you not to... I don't know how to tell you to change that. Other than the obvious things is not having a bunch of sugar or coffee or... you know, amphetamines or something like that before you go to sleep. But that's pretty obvious, you know, so to have a kind of a balanced, more balanced diet and that type of thing. Without a lot of things that will really pump up your system, like sugar and caffeine and things like that. This sounds like a bigger problem, bigger situation. I wouldn't say problem unless it's a problem for you, but it's a bigger situation. I don't know. I don't know how healthy that is for your body, too. Like, where is the deep sleep? Where is the deep rest? The body needs that. And so, that's the best I can do with that.
I have a question around that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I've heard... some people say, I don't think in the Vedanta tradition, but some people I heard said that dreams is kind of like prarabdha, that we're exhausting, that we don't have to live out in kind of the vyavaharika world. Hmm. So it's kind of like a milder form of exhausting that karma. Is that something that the Vedas say?
Puja Swamiji or Vakishan?
No.
You must get that from somewhere. Mm. I'm not sure, I don't know.
Mm.
I know something a little bit similar, and that is, you know, when for a jnani, when you leave the body, there may be some scars and things that are not quite resolved, and those will be enacted and like imagined out in the subtle plane. It's called krama mukti, and videya mukti means when the body drops, then there's nothing there. It's just the liberation. You're no longer exhausting, you know, some scars and desires and things that are there in as the jiva srishti that's over. Sometimes it's not, and when that's the case, then there's a gradual liberation that in the other planes you're exhausting these karmas. Okay. And so maybe there could be something in the Brahma Sutras that I'm not aware of or I don't remember, you know, where with the dreams you can be exhausting some karmas, but I'm not sure about it. We have to ask Swamiji and see where he picks that up. He got it from somewhere. He's not just saying it, he got it somewhere. That would be interesting to know.
It's karma mukti again.
Krama mukti.
Krama is
like an order, like you. A krama is an order. First this, then this, and this, and this. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you leave the body, but that liberation is, the jiva term is still there because there's just things inside that need to be exhausted, but not much. So it's exhausted on the subtle plane. And then when that's gone, then you're free to that. And then you just abide as Ishwara. We'll get into that near the end of the Dutra Bodha. They talk about that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
When I'm in a period of meditating every day, like now, I seem to need less sleep. It's always the same after the days of meditation. I wake up super early without getting tired. How can this be? Well, you know, if you meditate for some time, you go into a very, the whole body enjoys a very deep relaxation. The mind, even the mind, is totally relaxed, you know. There might, unless there's a lot of, some scars and a lot of trauma and things coming up. But I think to be absorbed in meditation is as good as being asleep. And in fact, even a little deeper sometimes. You know, because of the depth of the relaxation. And there is kind of a similarity between deep sleep and samadhi, in fact. Because in both, really, there's no duality. There's nothing bothering you at all. And so the level of relaxation is so much. So it can, perhaps, with that type of deep rest, can lessen your need for deep sleep. Even though in deep sleep there's a lot of chemistry that takes place also, and a lot of things kick in that are very, very useful for you. But still, I think it's something that's talked about, even in the tradition, that the sudden relationship to meditation kind of reduces the need for sleep. Yeah. So. In order to understand satyam better, what is the meaning of humans' evolution in the satyam? Is humans' evolution just bubbles in the big ocean of satyam? Okay. First of all, satyam, when we say satyam or mithya or tucham, that's not a thing, that's an order of reality. So there is no such thing as satyam, but something that has that ontological order that we call satyam is itself free from time. That which can't be destroyed or, you know, changed in past, present, or future. So that which is free of the past, not changed by the past, present, or future. That's the definition of satyam. So what is that that could have that ontological order that we call satyam? It's really only Brahman. And Brahman being free from time is free actually from time and space. It's free from the whole creation. And so Brahman is not going to be big or small, you know, because you need space for that. You have to be within space to be big or small. But if you're free from space and you're free from time, then these ideas of size or color and all these things are inapplicable. You're non-dual. You know, there's nothing but you. But that doesn't make you big or small. To be big or small, you have to have space. You have to have dimension. It has to be compared with something else also. You know, so here, so that's the first thing. So you say, in order to understand Satyam better, what is the meaning of human evolution? So from the standpoint of Satyam, there is no evolution because there is no change. The Atma, the self, is free from time and space, free from change. And so the being that I am now is the being that I always have been, always will be, absolutely free from time. I am the eternal presence. That my this me never wavers. It's not shifting through time, changing through time like that takes place in the world. So now when we're talking about human evolution, we're talking about the human being who has taken birth and birth and birth and birth and birth over the eons in this creation. So say this creation, if we look at the creation as cyclical, that which comes into being is sustained and goes into unmanifest condition, that is taking place over literally millions and millions of years. When we look at the yugas, the four yugas, that's not 1 or 200 years, that's millions of years. They have that all marked, they have that all down exactly. If you want, you can look in Wikipedia, they've kind of have a whole section on that if you want to understand time, the Hindu cosmology, and break down the yugas and the kalpas within the kalpas and the mahakalpas and all this. And you see, it's a huge, huge expanse of time. Within that time, the jivas are being born and reborn and reborn and reborn and reborn into human bodies or animal bodies or whatever their karma is. Now these physical upadis that are made of the same material as the earth, they can go through a process of evolution over literally millions of years. Evolution, you know, when Darwin and others are talking about, they're not talking about evolution that takes place in 100 years or 200 years or 300 years. Evolution takes, you know, thousands of years for major changes, and even more than that. Like if you think that humans evolved from amoebas or something like that, you know, that's taking place over millions of years. You have to understand what that means. There's no reason in the Vedas to say that that evolution is not there. It can as well be there. If it's scientifically proved, then we accept that. But that doesn't say anything about the sukshma sharira, the subtle body. The subtle body is subtle. It's not going through evolution. The self is not going through evolution because it's timeless. But the sukshma sharira can take bodies throughout time based upon your karma, and those bodies have gone through, if they have, over, and most of us accept evolution, some people don't, but most of us, it seems a convincing argument that evolution has taken place on this plane over millions of years. And so you can be, the jiva can be taking bodies which are appropriate to the time, and the human being is going to be what it is. And the caveman is going to be what the caveman is. And the prior condition to the caveman is going to be what that is. And your karma. You need to evolve. So depending upon your karmas, over the millennia, I mean, it's a large period of time. So in other words, evolution isn't negated and it need not be negated, but it belongs to this plane, to this physical body, not to the subtle body, not to, certainly not to the self. That makes sense? So, rest of it. What are we doing here? After taking a human body, is it possible to take an animal body again? Yes. It's not just an uphill evolution, right? It depends upon your karma. If the karmas in your last life are more fitting to have for an animal body, then you'll have an animal body. You'll get an animal body. There's even something. I believe there's something in the Brahma Sutras that you can even say if you've been really... It's better that you don't exist. If it's better that you don't exist, you can be born as a stone. You can take a stone body. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think I heard that. There's something like that in the Brahma Sutras, but definitely you can go up and down. You can take a Deva body just to exhaust punya. You can make another human body, a little bit less or a little bit better. Or you can take an animal body, or you can even be a worm in the earth. You can take the body of a plant. All depends upon your karma. And so it's not that the Sukshma Sharira is on this evolutionary path. It's a path. It's the bodies that you get are a result of dharma. Dharma and adharma. Punya and papa. So that's the... For all of that kind of, that's the Vedic vision. That is the vision of the Vedas. So you have to have Shraddha in the Vedas for that to be ring true for you. You know? I got confused around the prana and udana. Prana is exhalation, which is an upward, well, what they say outward, actually, you can say upward or outward. The prana is what is coming out. It's coming up from the lungs. The apana is going down, filling the lungs. The prana is going up and coming out. The apana is going in and going down. So it's like that. So I got confused around the prana and udana. Udana is within the body, that which can eject the whole, all of the prana, the life force out of the body. That's one of its main functions. The other is just the peristaltic movement of pushing up that will allow you to regurgitate food or to vomit or things like that. Yeah, so that's a different, totally different. Prana is exhalation, which is an upward movement, but udana is also an upward movement. That's true. They usually don't. The prana is not usually classified within udana, but it is true that the udana is the peristaltic movement of the body and also that which ejects the soul. The prana apana is the activity of the breath. I've never heard it identified with udana, but I see the point. This is the last one. The word vibhuti can mean all the glories of Bhagwan, but I think it is also one name for the ashes, yeah, we use in puja or on our forehead. Can you please talk about why this is so? No. I have no idea, but it's true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The ashes vibhuti. Do you know?
Well,
because Bhagavan's vibhutis are all Bhagavan's glories.
Yes.
Why is the ash called vibhuti also?
Well, Swami just says that like, when everything burns to ashes, then or like. Like Shiva, everything burns to ashes, and what stays are just ashes. Once everything is destroyed by the light of knowledge, and it's just what is ashes. And then you put that as a symbol on your
that's
your
true,
forehead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's our meaning for vibhuti when it's just the ash that you put on the forehead. But what about all the vibhutis, like the Himalayas of all of the. Among all of the mountains, the Himalayas is, you know, the great vibhutis, Bhagavan's vibhuti,
mm-hmm.
His glories. Of all of the rivers, that's the Ganga, you know. And so say Swamiji will use the example of all the tennis players. It's Jimmy Collins. Or, is that his name?
Jimmy Connors.
Jimmy Connors. Oh my gosh, how could I forget his name? That was many years ago, decades ago, but Swamiji was the greatest Jimmy Connors fan. Of all of the tennis players, Jimmy Connors is the good team. All the musicians like that. And I don't know exactly what that, why are they called the same thing? Yeah. We can look it up in the dictionary, yeah. Look it up in terms of the etymology of the word and see. Probably be there. Yeah. Because both are common meanings. I've realized that fact, but I've never looked into it. Yeah. Exactly why, and I've never heard Swamiji compare these two.
No, mm.
Okay, we have a few more. One more left. I may not answer it. Let me see if it's really easy. Are the devatas jivas? Yes. And that's a stanam that you can take because of great punya. What is the difference between deva and devata? You know, that question has wafted through my mind. But I don't really know. I think the devatas are the devas. I think it's the same. I think it's synonymous. Anybody know any different than that? Do you? Do you know any different? I mean, the root is the same also. The root is div, that which shines and is self-luminous. And so because of that, this word deva can be just used for Ishwara and for Brahman. And it is. In the Upanishads, you'll see just deva. I've never seen devata used for anything except all of the devatas, and I don't know. They're also called the devas. So I don't know that there's a difference.
Swamiji would call it like computer devata and motorcycle devata and everything.
Everything's, yeah.
It's functional as a devata.
But he's correct also. Swamiji also says that because there is a devata for everything. Because there's Bhagavan's order. So what you're really calling the devata is whatever that order is that allows that thing to be. You know, so.
And like Shiva Saraswati, you wouldn't call a devata, right? They're more like devas.
Yeah, that's true. You wouldn't call them a devata.
Maybe there's a little difference.
I don't call them a deva either.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Worth pondering over, but I don't have a definitive answer for you, do you?
Well, that more like the devatas are all the everything that has a devata.
Yeah.
But then deva is more like Shiva, Mahadeva, or Devi.
Mahadeva.
Devi, like Ishvara, not Ishvara with all worship and all worship, and deva, Devi, and devata are more.
Maybe.
I
mean,
that's how I.
Yeah. No, I can go there too, but I've seen deva used for the devatas, but I haven't heard devata used for like Krishna, I mean like Shiva or Brahma or Vishnu or any of the major devas. I haven't heard it. I've heard devas be used for devatas, but for especially Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, I can't imagine them be calling them devata. Yeah. Okay. Let's say just, let's go to bed. Om swasti prajapyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini Desho yamsho bharahitaha brahmana santu nirbhayaha om sarvesham swastir bhavatu sarvesham shantir bhavatu sarvesham purnam bhavatu
Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu. Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha. Sarve Santu Niramayaha. Sarve Bhatrani Pashyantu. Ma Kaschit Dukha Bhavet. Asatoma Satkamaya. Tamasoma Jyotirgamaya. Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya. Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudakshate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.